Hello and welcome. You're tuned into the best in true crime talk radio. This is True Crime Tuesday. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. That guy over there, Tim Dennis. This week, folks, I'm going to be open and honest with you. This week, next week, going to be a little bit different. We have no dumb crimes, stupid criminals to share with you. We are pre-recording these shows because I'm on the road filming for the next 2 weeks. So I will not have updated dumb crimes, stupid criminals until we are back. But I promise you, we will then have 3 weeks worth of dumb crime, stupid criminals to report to you when we are back running at full steam. But we still have interviews for you. That's why you tune in to hear these strange crimes from all around the world. So thank you for being a part of the program with us and understanding. And I can't wait to talk about the project I'm filming, Tim. It's an amazing mesh of true crime and the supernatural. That'll be hopefully coming out a little bit later this year. That's all the information I can release at this point, but it'll cross over into both of our worlds. So it'll be an exciting time, and I can't wait for people to tune in. And I've got some great friends that are going to be a part of the program with me. So it'll be cool. As a matter of fact, one of the buddies of ours, Tim, mm-hmm. I think this is the first time we get to legitimately work together on a TV program. We've both been on programs where we're part of it, but we're not working together. This is the first time we're going to be hand in hand facing the questions posed in this episode, the special. So I'm pretty psyched. I haven't even told Tim about this yet, so I don't mean to sound elusive to all of you, but even Tim is in the dark on the program that I'm working on because of what we're doing. So we will keep you updated and let you know what's going on. I also want to remind you that we have got a brand new release of the Holzer Files now on Discovery Plus. You'll be able to tune into Discovery Plus for the final 7 episodes of Holzer Files beginning on February 6th. And every week they will release a brand new episode. So you'll be able to catch up and continue to see the best in paranormal TV programming, the Holzer Files on Discovery Plus. Let's get to the topic at hand here, Tim. We've got a guest joining us right now to discuss a book called Satin Pumps and the Moonlight Murder that mesmerized the nation. Steve Kozareff, our guest this evening. Steve, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
I love when we can take a look back at older cases and stories that are fascinating but seem to have eluded many of us. And, you know, you hear some really fascinating tales from the past. Of course, you know, you've got the Lizzie Bordens and the Jack the Rippers and this case and then that case. But some of them being regional or even statewide, they may have drawn the attention of that area at that time, but then the rest of the world is still left kind of unknowing to these cases. And I was surprised because reading through, I had never heard of this story and it was huge. How did this tale come to you?
It actually got international press, and a lot of it was due to Carol Tregoff, was one of the accused and later became a convicted murderer. And because she had, she was sort of a sex kitten, Mata Hari type, she was very attractive. The press loved photographing her, and she sort of spearheaded this thing, helped keep the word alive through the 3 trials in the 2 years that this kind of gripped the nation's attention. And it is interesting that, you know, it was a regional murder, but man, people jumped on it. There were international reporters that came. Eric Ambler, the noted British author, was here. Dorothy Kilgallen from What's My Line? She was a noted journalist also. And it had that kind of cachet to it.
Wow. And Dorothy Kilgallen, she died rather mysteriously as well while working on the JFK story, I believe, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, there's been, you know, a conspiracy theory floating around about what happened to her for decades now.
Right.
And, you know, she didn't get her due as a criminal journalist. She had covered the Sam Shepard case 5 years earlier. So she had, you know, quite a history of journalism in addition to her her panel duties on What's My Line.
Well, let's dig into this case and go back in time together The book, again, Satin Pumps, The Moonlit Murder That Mesmerized the Nation. It's the early evening of July 18, 1959. Why don't you introduce us to the players in this sordid story?
Well, the person who set the whole thing into motion was Dr. Bernard Finch. And he was a local doctor in the Eastern San Gabriel Valley whose family history went back at least 50 years. They helped develop a good portion of the city of Covina. And his grandfather was a founding father of the city of Covina. And they owned a number of businesses. They had originally, the grandmother, great-grandmother had actually come out from Virginia, I believe. No, maybe Tennessee. In 1881, she followed her eldest son. She had seven children, and came out here. She joined him in Northern California. Eventually, they made their way to Covina. Well, the Finch family established itself. They made quite a bit of money. They were pretty well known. Dr. Finch's father was not only an optometrist, but he also co-owned with his brother Finch Jewelers in Covina. And they were pretty well known in the area. And Dr. Finch was kind of the golden boy growing up in Covina. And his path was set very early on. And I don't know how much decision of his was involved, but he decided he was going to be a medical doctor at a very young age. He graduated from high school at 16, went to what is now Laverne, or was then Laverne College, and then to a medical school in near San Bernardino. And he met his future brother-in-law there, Dr. Gordon, Franklin Gordon, and they together built the West Covina Medical Clinic, which opened in 1950. And it did very well. The area was developing. Herbs were going up. Orange trees were coming down. And they did very well and decided at that point around the mid-50s to build a hospital there. And just about this time, Dr. Finch had been married and divorced his wife for a woman that he met by the name of Barbara Jean Doherty. And she was married. She had been a patient of his. And she was pregnant at the time, and he treated her. And then after the baby was born, she started working for him as a medical assistant. She was very bright, intelligent, and beautiful. And she, began this affair. And then eventually, they had ended up living next door to each other in Baldwin Park. And I don't know quite how they orchestrated that, but they did eventually. She left her husband and married Dr. Finch. And he was in the process of building this expensive home.
Wait a minute. So he's dating this woman.
Yes.
And he lives in a home. Somehow they're able to orchestrate for his girlfriend and her husband to buy the home directly next to him.
Yeah, they're Barbara Finch somehow and Dr. Finch. Actually, Barbara Jean Doherty at the time, they orchestrated somehow moving next door to each other. And Barbara Finch and her husband had lived in Baldwin Park already, but somehow the house became available next door. And Dr. Finch and his then wife, Frances, moved in. And that's when the affair began. Now, how they managed to, the timing and to live next door and carry on is quite remarkable. I go into that a little bit in the book. But eventually, they ended up getting respective divorces. They got married, and she moved in with Finch into their hilltop home in West Covina, which in the early 1950s, I think 1953, she gave birth to their son shortly thereafter. And the marriage was pretty good for a few years, but Finch always had a wandering eye. And there is a notation in court documents about his affairs with employees, female employees, at the West Covina Medical Clinic. He was quite a charmer and very handsome, and the women were sort of falling over each other to be involved with him. And so he had a history, at least at West Covina Medical Clinic, if not at previous hospitals that he worked at. And so they were living in this hilltop home. Their marriage was pretty good. And then Carol Tragoff came along. At the time, I believe she was 19 years old. She was looking for a job. She was hired at West Covina Medical Clinic initially as a receptionist. And then a position opened up as Finch's medical assistant. And she was hired. And she was very bright. She had a great memory. As a seven-year-old, I remember her taking notes when I was there to have visits with Dr. Finch. I was a patient of his. And I remember her just writing furiously. And she was standing right behind him taking notes as he was examining me. And that's my impression that's sort of burned into my memory of her. And eventually...
You actually have a tie to this story in the sense of being in that area and interacting with these people.
Yes, I grew up in Charter Oak, which is only a few miles from Finch's Hilltop home in West Covina. And Finch actually lived at one time just about a mile away from where my family home was, but it was a number of years earlier. His sister, youngest sister Jane, actually lived three blocks away from my parents. And it turns out that my best friend in high school, his mother was friends with Jane Finch. She ended up moving in a house, and this was many years later, moving in a house like across the street from my friend's mother. So our paths cross a lot, but Dr. Finch was also our family doctor. He delivered me and delivered the oldest of my three younger sisters and treated our family until the murder. Well, actually, a little before that, there's an interesting story as to how we ended up moving over to his brother-in-law at the medical clinic. And that was about 9 months or so before Barbara Finch died.
All right. When you are looking back at a case like this, and obviously we're getting to the crime, when you look at the information regarding Dr. Finch, do you start to see through, again, the gift of hindsight, this guy was kind of a rogue element through most of his life, or did he always seem to walk the pretty straight and narrow?
Well, he was pretty self-entitled. He was kind of a golden boy, and his family, I think, contributed a lot to that. He could do no wrong. He had a drinking problem. He would be pulled over by the police, and, you know, white male privilege, they'd let him go, or they would have arrested somebody else. And he just seemed to breeze right through things, you know, through school, medical school. His family was always written about in the local newspaper. He excelled at playing the cornet. He could sing. And he was also a very good tennis player. He played in high school, in college, and tennis was, you know, sort of his thing for forever. And he actually later on, when he, you know, had some money, he joined the Los Angeles Tennis Club, which is noted for having a lot of celebrity players there.
All right, so you've got this kind of guy who was living maybe a gifted life, right? And as you said, kind of an entitled life. But do we see any predilection for, you know, cruelty towards others, something that would lead us down this path that would, you know, reveal that this guy was kind of maybe not all there from the get-go?
No, that's what's interesting, is that you really don't. You know, the only thing you might say is the way he treated women. He had no problem with having affairs with women. And he sort of looked down upon women, you know, which was typical of the era for what men did at the time. And a lot of that came out in the trials, just exactly how he thought of his wives and sort of how he treated them. You know, they had access to money. And this brings up another thing about how women who were smart and ambitious at the time didn't have a lot of opportunities as far as careers. And so they often used their husbands or, you know, sort of attached themselves to, you know, those careers that their husbands had. And that happened in the case with Barbara Finch and later with Carol Tregoff, as they both worked as medical assistants. Another interesting thing is that in the book, as far as the Los Angeles Tennis Club goes, Gail Patrick Jackson, who was the producer of the Perry Mason TV series, her husband was the president of Los Angeles Tennis Club, and the Finches were friends with them. And Gail Patrick Jackson is kind of an interesting, she sort of follows this trajectory where she marries a man of some wealth and notoriety. She married Cornwell Jackson, who was Earl Stanley Gardner's literary agent. And through that connection, she started to think about the Perry Mason TV series. And it's interesting to wonder if she didn't have that connection to Earl Stanley Gardner through her husband, whether she would have ever been able to get the Perry Mason TV series off the ground. But they sort of interweave through this story as the trials go on, and you find out some, and there were some instances and events that took place at the Los Angeles Tennis Club.
All right, so we have glimmers of who he is, but it's not like we're dealing with a lifelong criminal or somebody with blatant disregard. And being a doctor, obviously he has some empathy and understanding for people and caring, but he's cavalier in his approach towards women overall. Well, but that's the only thing we could say. And is that too different than many men of that era?
No, but one of the questions that I bring up in the book is really, was Finch, did Finch become a doctor to actually heal people, or was he solely in it to enrich himself? And I sort of believe the latter, because there is a history of some malpractice suits that he was involved with. And I even have a personal connection to that, not a malpractice suit, but a botched tonsillectomy that he performed on me when I was 2 years old. I have the remnants, the roots of my tonsils still to this day due to his botched tonsillectomy. And, you know, he talked to my parents, who were young and unsophisticated at the time, and suggested and maybe convinced them that, you know, my allergies and breathing issues would go away if he removed my tonsils. So, you know, they were all for that. It happened and it didn't change a thing. But as I started to dig into the story, I actually found some of the malpractice suits that he was involved with directly or indirectly. And there were about 11 of them. And in a couple of cases, the children died. So I really start to wonder, you know, just how, you know, his medical career, how much it was based on wanting to help people and or to enrich himself. And I sort of believe the latter.
Really? So it was not so much for the wanting to better mankind. It was just more of the luxury of the money that would be brought in for that position and also in the standing he would have in the community.
Yeah, and, you know, here he was. He was at the right place at the right time with the Eastern San Gabriel Valley developing and all these suburbs. The San Bernardino Freeway was being built right in front of the medical clinic, and this was a major artery from Los Angeles through San Bernardino and on to Palm Springs. So he was in the right place when they had built the medical clinic and then the hospital. And I think I refer to it as shooting fish in a barrel. They really couldn't do any wrong. And, you know, it making money. And he was sort of making it hand over fist. And in fact, he bragged about that at his trials. He was really proud of what he had done. And at the time of the first trial, his estate was valued at something in 2021 dollars would be about $6 million. And for a local sort of non-celebrity doctor, that was a pretty good chunk of change.
Hmm. Now, this this initial affair that he was a part of that brought him into his second marriage with Barbara, it mm-hmm. fell apart. Was it the magic of the allure of the naughtiness of what they were doing once they actually got one another? It just didn't hold up. Is that kind of the concept here?
Are you talking about his affair with Barbara before he married her, or his affair with Carol Tregoff?
No, well. Just trying to understand his, so he was married prior to being married to Barbara, correct?
His first wife's name was Frances, and he had three right. children by her.
Okay.
And yeah, it's hard, you know, I sort of think not only was he involved, but I think he could be easily swayed by women. He was sort of a patsy in that way, you know. It's whatever they said, he was, you know, he was there. And I don't think he really thought these things through, getting involved and then later married to these women, because, you know, he had a wandering eye that just wouldn't stop. And even through his affair with Barbara and marriage, and then even his affair with Carol Tregoff while he was married to Barbara, he was still carrying on with other women at the West Covina Medical Clinic. So I don't know how he didn't seem to be too concerned about being caught or found out or necessarily trying to hide these things. It's almost like it was his right to do these things.
Hmm.
And that was my sense of researching this book, of what I found out.
And as a sideline, I mean, you're a screenwriter as well and do this work. Is that what, you know, fleshing this story out, was it something that you saw as a screen adaptation? Did you see that and then just realize, hey, this is a pretty remarkable story to put together as a book?
Yeah, let me tell you how this came about. You know, for years I had sort of toyed with the idea of writing a book about this and was involved with other projects and so on. And then a friend told me that he was friends with this big television producer who was involved with the Law and Order television series. And I thought, well, you know, I'm going to write something and send it to him. And I thought, you know, I had a couple projects in mind. And I thought, you know, this one seems to have the most commercial feasibility. It might be right up his alley. So I actually wrote this Finch Tregoff project as a limited television series. I created a treatment for it. And then, as it turns out, you know, people are involved in their own things. And he was cutting back. He was moving in another direction. So here I am left holding this treatment. And I thought, you know, I think I'm going to do that book. I've got enough stuff here. And I went ahead and I started to delve deeper into the characters, because it really needed their backstories. You needed to get into things that the television series either wouldn't handle or wouldn't have enough time to delve into. So I started to use a genealogical site and found out some just amazing things and was able to piece these people's backstories together to actually show how their characters developed and why they did what they did. And so the book goes into that in quite some detail and actually interweaves sort of my history, my family history, with the history of Dr. Finch and Carol Tregoff. And it's sort of the history of Southern California, too, you know, as you back out of that. And so it was, you know, it was first a limited series treatment, and then it became the book. And, you know, I did obviously a lot more extensive research and found out a lot more than what I knew when I even did the treatment for the limited series. So.
Very cool. It's interesting when you have that kind of tie to it and know that area and the history and the lay of the land of that era so well as you did. Now, as we're piling up into the crime itself, what can you tell us about Carol Ann Tregoff? I mean, I know you started to set the stage, but what was her personality like? Was she well-liked? Was she considered a mean girl, a manipulator? What all do we know about her before her connection with Dr. Finch?
Well, initially, she came from a broken home. Her father was a Russian emigre, and sort of like my family. And her parents were married a few years. Her mother had some mental issues and had actually physically attacked her father with a knife. And the parents got divorced. Carol really loved her father, James, and she wanted to go with him, but she was forced to stay with her mother and her stepfather, which was not a happy situation, because the mother was still, you know, obviously getting remarried doesn't change your mental state. So the mother would get into these huge arguments, and Carol, during the trials, talked about hiding in closets and trying to tune out the fights between her mother and stepfather and her father prior to that. And that also became one of the defense issues that they raised as to what she said she did to try and back that up. But eventually her father remarried. And when Carol, I believe, was about 7 years old, she went to live with them. And oddly enough, it was like night and day this new relationship she had with her new stepmother. And they were like two peas in a pod. I mean, they couldn't be closer. I think, as I said, as if they were conjugal twins in the book. And they had a great relationship. Her stepmother was very supportive of her growing up. And she lived with both her parents. They lived in a couple places, including Boyle Heights, which was a lower class section of Los Angeles, where my family had once lived. And then they ended up moving to a house in Pasadena. And Carol went to Huntington Park High School, which oddly enough, my mother went to about 8 years earlier. And she graduated from there. But prior to graduation, she met a guy named James Papa. And he was a gymnast at El Sereno High School, I believe, in Eagle Rock. And she didn't think too much of him at the point, but he was sort of smitten with her. And then eventually they reconnected again. And they ended up getting married. They, after she graduated from high school, he had done a 2-year hitch in the Marines trying, waiting for her. And he figured if he did that, she'd graduate from then and then they could get married. And, you know, at the time, that's what a lot of young women did. You know, they didn't necessarily think of going to college. Their parents talked them into it. And it was sort of the thing. You know, a lot of young women got married right out of high school and Carol did the same. But then she realized she wasn't in love with Jimmy Papa, and he wasn't that exciting after a while. So she was a bored young housewife, and she thought she'd get a job. And she found an ad in a local newspaper magazine about a receptionist that was needed at Wiscovina Medical Clinic. So she went, was interviewed, and got the job. And that's how she eventually met Dr. Finch. So there was this early bad childhood, but then it changed. And she was ambitious. She was beautiful. And she knew how to work that to her advantage. And when she met Dr. Finch, they didn't initially become involved in a sexual affair. But there was a strong attraction, and he was about 41 at the time. She was 19, 20 years old. So, you know, he was old enough to be her father, but it was a very strong attraction, and that's sort of how they got involved.
All right, and with this, she's fully aware of his current status and what's going on with him, but do you think it's the... And I hate to use this kind of tired trope, but is she looking for that father she never had growing up? Is she, you know, is it a girl looking the attention of an older man in approval?
She told an interviewer, a reporter at one time, that she was just attracted to older men. And I don't think it was a daddy issue per se, because she had a very close relationship with her father. She wasn't searching for a father, but she was attracted to older men. And, so Finch sort of fit that bill, you know, obviously, and I'm sure that his good looks and his money didn't hurt, you know, so.
All right, fair enough. So they're connected now. They start this affair. Is it something, you know, it almost seems he's kind of cavalier in his attitude. Is this something he's hiding, that they're hiding, or is he kind of hiding in plain sight with what they're doing?
They ended up getting a series of apartments after they were, you know, sure that this affair was going to go somewhere and locally. So she was there in the apartment after she left Jimmy Papa. And there was actually kind of a hilarious, and I'm sure he didn't think so at the time, instance where she was out one night with Finch. They had gone to the Luau in Beverly Hills, which was, you're familiar with it, was a very famous Beverly Hills Hollywood restaurant that was owned by Stephen Crane, who was Lana Turner's ex-husband. And it's also the restaurant where Lena Horne decided to take on a racist there and threw a lamp and about 3 ashtrays at him. So this place was a Polynesian restaurant famous for its drinks at the time. And as you probably that heard Polynesian restaurants were quite the thing at the time. So Finch liked Polynesian restaurants. He and Carol went there, and they had a series of scorpions for two. And those drinks are probably will put you on your ass. You know, they're very strong. And they had driven up after, I don't know if they got kicked out of the restaurant or they left on their own, but they decided they were going to go for a moonlight drive. And they ended up in the Hollywood Hills, parked, and were admiring, you know, the lights of Los Angeles down below. Carol eventually gets home about 4:30 in the morning, and her husband has been up all night wondering where she's been and confronts her, and she won't really say anything. And he ends up calling Finch, and he's still kind of not aware of what's going on, oddly enough, because he's so full of himself. And he calls Finch, and he tells him that Carol isn't coming in that morning because she had been out all night. He is actually telling Finch, who had been out with Carol, that she had been out with somebody all night. So I can only imagine that Finch must have been stifling a laugh, after hearing this from Jimmy Papa.
Right.
So Finch says, that's fine with me. He goes, I probably have a little experience myself about being out all night. She can take the day off and recover. And shortly after that, it may have been like the next day. I don't have my notes in front of me to recall, but she ended up moving out. And Jimmy Papa came home the next day and opens the front door, and all the furniture is gone. Everything is gone except his clothes, and Carol Tregov was nowhere to be found. And Finch had provided an apartment, the first of a series of three, and that's where they carried on their affairs. They would go separately to the medical clinic. You know, they tried to maintain some propriety, but, you know, I'm sure everybody knew. And there was a point definitely where everybody knew for sure, because Jimmy Papa got mad, and he decided to go to the medical clinic and confront Finch. And so he spots Carol there, and they find Finch, and they go into a conference room and close the door. And Jimmy Papa just lets him have it. But Finch basically counters and says, you know, this is slander. He goes, if you don't stop this, he goes, I will sue you, and you will be working for me for the rest of your life. And he probably had that much clout that he could do that. But I'm sure that everybody, all the medical clinic employees, probably heard that conversation going on among the three of them. And that's when Dr. Gordon, who was Finch's brother-in-law and business partner, decided to do something. And Finch's status at the medical clinic and hospital changed shortly thereafter. What I do remember is that just about that time, my mother was pregnant with my middle sister. And Dr. Finch would have delivered her too, but then she started seeing Dr. Gordon. And Finch's duties were scaled back to the point of him not seeing patients on a day-to-day basis. He just ended up performing surgeries. And my thinking is that the medical clinic had to do something about Finch. That, you know, they knew, Dr. Gordon knew about his affairs. They were probably afraid of lawsuits, and medical malpractice and just about everything you can think of. So I believe that the medical clinic sent out a letter after a board meeting, and they told their patients that Dr. Finch was scaling back his duties and that they would have to find another doctor at the medical clinic. And I'm thinking that's how my mother and my family ended up going to see Dr. Gordon after Dr. Finch, because about 9 months before Barbara Finch was murdered, Dr. Gordon delivered my sister Debbie. She was actually the first baby born at West Covina Hospital.
All right. Well, it's a lot of swallow. I mean, so many different people and so much kind of, I don't know, you got so many hands reaching out, so many people doing shady things in this dealing. It's hard to really have sympathy for anybody at this point, isn't it?
Yeah. There is a point where it gets where finally Finch, at the time, California did not have community property laws. If a wife or a spouse could prove adultery, the person suing that spouse could basically end up with everything. It was not split 50-50 as it is now. There was no-fault divorce at the time. There wasn't any no-fault divorce at the time. So Finch was worried about his finances. And Barbara decided at one point she finally had enough. So she was seeking a divorce and at the same time trailing, hiring private detectives to trail Finch and Carol. And they ended up bugging one of the apartments in some time. And I'm sure they got some great recordings, but whatever happened to the recordings, they were entered into court at one of the first murder trial. But I have not heard what happened to those recordings. It'd be interesting to hear those. I'm sure there was some great stuff on them. But, and it might have even been, they might have at that point been thinking about plotting Barbara's death at the point. At some point, Carol is feeding stuff, you know, saying sweet nothings into his ear. We need to do something about your wife. You know, I want to marry you. I'm not so sure at that point she thought murder, but I'm starting to think that as they felt that Finch was going to lose everything, his standing, and that Barbara could literally end up with all his cash in the hospital, that he needed to do something. She ended up, once this affair became public and Barbara was going to sue for divorce, they thought the best thing for Carol to do was to get out of town. She quit her job as Finch's medical assistant and moved to Las Vegas and started working as a cocktail waitress at the Sands Hotel. About that same time, they started to think about what they could do about Barbara. And they started to look for a hitman in Las Vegas. And this shows just how they didn't have any street smarts and they weren't killers themselves. Carol started to check around through her sources, and she's introduced to this guy named Jack Cody. Now, Jack Cody was no killer. He was a con man, and he would just as soon take the money out of your pocket as murder you. But he managed to convince them. He was conning the killers. He conned Carol and Dr. Finch, told them he could do the job, and they were pretty desperate. You know, they didn't look into this too deeply. But they ended up...
Wait a minute. They didn't get him from iHire.com? There was no reference guide that came with this?
No, not at all. And Jack Cody is one of the great characters in the book because of who he is. And, you know, he promises he's going to kill him and kill Barbara Finch for them. And they set this up. It's supposed to take place over the July 4th weekend in 1959. So they ended up buying him a plane ticket. They put him drunk on the plane after they've partied with him. And he comes back and he tells him he did it. He tells Carol he did the job and she's excited about that. And then she calls Finch and tells him that. But Finch is just, he's just not quite sure. So he ends up calling his home and his wife answers the phone. So obviously she's very much alive. Oh, they meet with Jack Cody.
Wait a minute. Now, do they go in temporary panic that he might have killed the wrong person?
Well, what he did is they meet with him, and before Finch announces that about his wife, Jack Cody says, they ask about the job, and he says, well, Barbara Finch was allegedly staying with some girlfriends of hers in Hollywood to get away from Finch's physical abuse, which had started at this point. And she's staying, he said he went to this Hollywood apartment, he shot a woman with a shotgun, and he put her in the trunk of the car. And then Finch, knowing that Barbara's alive, was saying, you must have killed the wrong woman. And he says, you know, you need to make this right. They don't seem to be too worried about the friend being shot, you know, an innocent victim. So they set this up again. And Jack Cody is supposed to perform this again. And
at this point, is Jack Cody charging them for a second hit? Because now he'll supposedly have two people that he's taking care of.
Yeah, she had, I don't believe he's charging for a second hit. She had paid him, I think he may have had all the money at this point. But he was sort of caught. The police were looking for him for other things. And so I don't really think he could get some more money. But there is a point where when Barbara Finch is actually killed, he does claim that he murdered her. And he told a friend of his he wanted to get a hold of Finch because he wanted to collect the money. So he was going to try and double dip on something that he hadn't even done. But they send him back out there to do it again.
Wait a minute. So when he gets wind that she's dead, he decides he's going to cash in and say he did the deal.
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah, that's what he told the court.
This sounds like a Tarantino movie.
It pretty much. This guy was quite a character. And the one thing, he was kind of a scumbag. He was a witness for the prosecution, and the defense thought, the jury's just going to see through him, and they're not going to believe a word he said. But the one thing that Jack Cody had going in his favor, he always told the truth. And even on the witness stand, he would tell the truth. And eventually, that's sort of what helped convict them after three trials, is that he did stick to the truth. And Finch's high-priced criminal attorney, Grant Cooper, who would later be known for defending Sirhan Sirhan in the Robert Kennedy assassination case, he was just flummoxed by Jack Cody. He tried to do everything he could to discredit him, and yet Cody telling the truth sort of always saved the day as far as the prosecution was concerned.
Well, he always told the truth, yet he came and said that he shotgunned a woman that he didn't kill.
He didn't tell Finch and Carroll the truth.
Oh, okay.
But he did in court later on, and he is one of the great characters in the story.
He's an accidental hero, right? Yeah.
Oddly enough, he that's what he turns out to be, and so now after the second attempt, they have. Barbara Finch is still alive. They have a reconciliation court date has been sent. Finch is faking his way through that just to buy time. And he has made a couple visits to the house prior to Jack Cody allegedly attempting to kill her. And he has actually physically abused his wife a couple of times where she's required some medical attention. And in fact, there's one time he shows up, beats her up. She ends up falling, cuts her eye on a nightstand next to the bed, and he ends up taking her to West Covina Medical Clinic to stitch it up. But she doesn't initially want to get in the car because he basically has told her their plan had started to formulate at this point, and what he and Carol were going to do, they were going to drug her. At the house, he was going to insert an air bubble into her system to kill her, and they were going to put her lifeless body into this beautiful 1957 Chrysler 300C convertible automobile and send it over a ravine next to his house. That was their plan. And Finch had basically told her he didn't censor himself. He said, I could hire somebody in Las Vegas to kill you. And she was afraid, and she had told a number of people, including her divorce attorney, that she would not get in a car with Finch. She was afraid he was either going to take her up to the mountains and kill her there or out into the desert, and nobody would ever find her body. And he had told her that in so many words. So now, with Jack Cody failing to kill Barbara Finch, Carol and Finch are left to do the deed themselves. And their plan is still to, neutralize her, kill her by giving her an overdose of Seconal and putting her body in the car and sending it over the cliff. And they actually plan the date. And they end up driving from Las Vegas. Carol, after work, early in the evening, about 6 o'clock, picks up Finch at her apartment. And they do the five-hour drive in her car. She has a 1955 bronze and white DeSoto convertible. And it's a beautiful car if you've ever seen them. And they drive the 5 hours to the house. And when they get there, Finch walks up first up the hill to the house. They park at the South Hills Country Club, which is a golf and a tennis club, which is just down below the hill across the street from the Finch home. And they park her car there, and Finch tells Carol he'll give her a signal when everything is clear. So he walks up the hill. This is July 18th, about 11 o'clock at night. Very warm. It's very bright moonlight. And he walks up the hill. He manages, there's a floodlight that he yanks the cord out. And he surveils the house, and Barbara's car is gone. She's not home. So he calls Carol up and signals her, and she walks up was later termed by the police as the murder kit. And this has all the things they're going to use to kill Barbara. It includes latex gloves, syringes, Seconal, rope to tie her up, you name it. And so Carol brings this murder kit up, and they decide to wait for Barbara hidden on the lawn. And eventually she had gone out earlier that day to the Los Angeles Tennis Club to play tennis. She was friends with Vera Allen, the actress,
right? White Christmas and On the Town. Yeah. Right.
On the Town. Yeah. She was friends with Vera Allen, who later attended her funeral. And she was friends with Mark Stevens, who is a famous film noir actor and director, who also did a lot of television in the 1950s. And in fact, Barbara had talked to Stevens on at least one occasion before, and she told him about Finch's threats and the abuse and everything. And Mark Stevens told her, well, you should get a gun. And she told him, well, I don't know how to use one. I'm afraid of guns. And so he marches her over to the trunk. She was driving the Chrysler at the time, pulls the trunk open and pulls the jack handle out and gives it to her. And she says, he goes, you use this. If Finch ever abuses you again, you tell him, you say hello with this. And so he puts the jack handle in the back of the back seat of the car on the floorboard. The police would later find that jack handle underneath her bed. So it got as far as there, but she never had a chance to use it. So she's at the Los Angeles Tennis Club. She's met a couple friends there. They had cocktails. They ended up going to a steakhouse for dinner after that. And she came back, picked up her car, and she left just about the time that Finch and Carol were arriving at the house at 11. She was leaving the Los Angeles Tennis Club, which is about a half-hour drive back to their home in West Covina. And so she pulls into the driveway, and Finch is coming in right behind the car, and Carol is just a little distance behind him. And he confronts her, and all of a sudden, the plan to neutralize her and kill her, you know, drug her and put her in the car, changed, because when he confronts her, he decides he has a gun and hits her with the butt of the gun in the back of the head, which knocks her out for a few seconds, but she manages to come to, and there's a struggle, and during the struggle she's hit at least one other time, but he doesn't neutralize her to put her into the car. What happens, there's an unexpected visitor. The Finches had a Swedish 19-year-old nanny who took care of their kids. She heard Barbara call out to her and ran into the garage through a side door. So Barbara's lying unconscious on the floor, and the nanny runs in to turn on the light. Finch runs over to her, slams her against the wall with his elbow, turns the light off, and knocks her head into the wall. And he knocked her into the wall so hard once or twice that it actually broke the concrete in the
what?
Wall. Yeah. And it was there. And then she's knocked out. He goes back to Barbara. He manages to half command her with a gun on her to get into the front seat of the car. He manages to get the nanny into the back seat, and to scare the nanny, he actually fired the gun. And at this point, Carol Tregoff, from what I found out and have been able to piece together, she ran. She'd been hiding in when the nanny ran into the garage. Carol Tregoff ran and hid in a bougainvillea bush on the side of the house. And once she heard that first gunshot, the warning shot that Finch fired in the garage to scare the nanny into the back of the car, Carol Tregoff took off down the hill. Now, she claims she hid in the bougainvillea bush for hours. But from an early report that I found that the police never seemed to find, she actually took off. By time, so she's running down the hill at this point. So now Finch has both the women in the car. He gets in to the side of the car, and his idea now is to send both women over the side of the ravine. So he's going to drive the car out, and he's asking where the key is. And finally realizes it's in the ignition of the car because the radio and the headlights are on. So he, just as he starts to deal with that, Barbara comes to and makes a beeline, bolts out of the front seat of the car, and starts to head out of the garage and down the driveway. Finch follows inside. The nanny runs inside to call the police. And Finch chases Barbara down the driveway, across a service road, and right into his parents' house, which is conveniently next door. As Barbara is starting to run down these seven dirt steps, Finch fires and shoots her in the back. She collapses and dies in her in-law's backyard. Carol Tregoff at this point, as she's gotten near the car, she's heard the second gunshot. She jumps in the car and takes off for Las Vegas. The nanny's called the police, and the police are on their way. Now, what Finch must do is sort of collect his thoughts. He's finally done what he wanted to do, but not in the way he wanted to do it. So somehow, and this never comes up in the court trials because it would implicate him in the murder, but somehow he manages Barbara's purse. He had dumped the contents out in the garage floor looking for the keys before he realized they were in the ignition. So, first of all, he collects the bullet had gone directly through Barbara's body. Somehow he finds the bullet and the shell casing. He goes back to the garage, collects her purse and the contents, and then starts running through the orange grove near the South Hills Country Club. He trips initially, but he manages to catch his thoughts and himself, and he continues on running to avoid the police, which are now on their way. And he manages to first not only steal one car, but two in the process, and drives to the West Covina Medical Clinic. Now, nobody has ever talked about what he did there, why he went there. And I actually come to a conclusion why he went there. And I tell you that at the end of the book. As he's pulling out of the West Covina Medical Clinic parking lot, the police spot him. He gets on the San Bernardino freeway heading towards Los Angeles, and now there's a high-speed chase. And at one point, there's up to 20 police cars chasing him. Somehow, he manages to elude the police. He gets off and switches back and starts heading back east on the San Bernardino freeway. But the police don't know that. They're still chasing. They happen to spot another 1955 Cadillac, which is similar to the one he ended up stealing. They run this car off the road. Their guns are drawn. They open the door, and there's an elderly woman at the wheel. And I imagine she was quite surprised that the police were there were a bunch of police holding guns on her. So now Finch is still heading east, and he eventually makes his way back to Las Vegas, where he rendezvous with Carol in the morning. And that's sort of it. There's more, a lot more detail in the book about the murder.
Mishmash of panic and bizarre reactions. Does Carol really kind of talk about what is going on through her mind through all of this, you know, to conceive it, to wish it to be true, to it actually coming to fruition? Was this, you know, what was that like?
I think at this point she still thought they could be together. Police initially didn't know what had happened. They knew she had been murdered. But then they, because of the, Barbara had made some calls to the police, and the police had gone out there when Finch had abused her. They knew about the history of her and her husband, so he obviously was the first suspect. So they end up, what happened? One of the cops who was not on duty at that point knew that Finch was involved with Carol Tregoff, and that she was actually, her former home with her husband was right next door, or about a block away from him and his family. So he had heard that she had moved to Las Vegas. So the police started looking for her, and the Las Vegas sheriffs had sent out a report. And one of the sheriffs had stopped her and knew that she worked at the Sands Hotel. So they went to the Sands Hotel early in the morning, and they found her and questioned her briefly, and she said that Finch was with her. So they went to pick him up, and then they later picked her up for questioning until the West Covina police were able to get to Las Vegas to pick him up. Still at this point, you know, I'm sure they thought she had some involvement, but they did not arrest her. They only, the West Covina police arrested Finch and took him back. She promised to be a witness. She drove back to West Covina, or actually South Pasadena, stayed with her family. And the next morning, they bring Finch and her, and they're on the scene of the crime, and they're looking for evidence. Finch is pointing out various things. He meets Grant Cooper for the first time, who has been hired as his attorney. And there's actually, they get to speak to each other privately. And my sense is that when they spoke to each other privately in a police car, when they were taking him to his hearing, is that they made sort of a pact. He promised her that he would not involve her in this murder. So she was feeling pretty good, I think, you know, that they hadn't arrested her, you know, that somehow Finch would get out of this. You know, she's a young woman. She's still thinking she's going to have her Prince Charming. And the hearing in West Covina was quite the show. And this is what started the whole 2 years of trials and the media frenzy about this. And actually, at the hearing, Gail Patrick Jackson and her husband Cornwell Jackson were there because they'd heard about this on the news. You know, so they were at the hearing. It was a small courtroom, and the judge is quite a character, Albert Miller. And they end up, Carol's on the witness stand during this hearing, and there's a big dramatic bombshell is dropped. The judge asked the assistant district attorney if she can be released now that she's done her testimony. And he says, "No, Your Honor, she's going to be arrested as soon as she steps off the stand." And that happened. The police ended up pulling her off the stand. The reporters asked her, did you know you were going to be arrested? And she says, "No, I did not." And she was not too happy about it. And during the hearing, she had the audacity. Finch had stolen clothes out of his wife's closet for Carol. She had the audacity to wear this expensive mink-trimmed suit that was Barbara Finch's. And the Swedish au pair, Marie-Anne Lindholm, recognized it along with several of Barbara's friends. So, you know, at the very least, they knew that, you know, there was a lot of stuff that was very untoward Barbara Finch going on. You know, everybody circled their wagons, and that's how the whole thing took off after the hearing, and it just became a media frenzy.
Oh, I gotta guess that media circus must have just exploded by seeing how this unfolds.
Well, you have, look at the characters. Here's a beautiful young woman, very photogenic. They couldn't take enough photographs of her. And then you have this handsome, wealthy doctor. There's sex, murder, money, love, madness, all this stuff. It just makes for, you know, what you see on a television program, you know. And it just fed itself and the extraneous carriers. Then you had Jack Cody. Not only were the two involved, but there was actually conspiracy with others. All that it entailed, it just managed to propel itself. And that first trial, they actually had the trial opened up the Hall of Justice in Los Angeles, which was a small courtroom they were in. And it grew to such size, they had to move the court to what was called the Circus Room at the Metropolitan Municipal Courthouse, which had just opened, I believe, the previous year. And this sat about 300 people in it. And, you know, half the media took at least half the seats. You know, by this time, you had international press, television, newsreel, magazine, newspapers, Dorothy Kilgallen, Gail Patrick Jackson. And in fact, the first day of the trial at the Metropolitan Courthouse, Dorothy Kilgallen brought a few of her friends, which included Clifton Webb and Sonia Henie. And she made a grand entrance herself into the courtroom. And I recount that in the book.
They had to go through the trial, did you say three times?
Three trials, yes. And the interesting thing, I forgot, besides the love, sex, money, there was actually racism involved in this. Through the third trial, Finch was pretty convincing. The big show days were his testimony and Carroll's. And during his testimony, he was quite an actor. He managed to sway jurors. There were three female jurors who were visibly shaken, crying while he's recounting how he tried to save his wife, that the whole thing was an accident, that the gun misfired when he threw it down on the ground. And he held his wife, she's dying in his arms, and tells him to take care of the kids. And she was sorry, she should have listened to him. And I mean, when you read this now, it sounds like, how did anybody believe this? But these women are just crying in the jury. So they were pretty sure that they were going to beat this rap, you know? And then when it gets down to the jury itself was an interesting mix. Obviously, besides a mix of men and women, there was a African-American man and a Latino man. And then one of the white women on the jury was, I mean, she probably had membership in the Klan because she was quite the racist. And they had some major fights, the jury did behind closed doors. And there were threats of violence. And finally, the African-American man and the Latino man decided that they joined forces and they were going to show, you know, these jurors, what they were made of. And they were the holdouts. So it actually ended in a mistrial. And I don't think Finch nor Carroll at the time, I don't know if they ever found out, but the only way that they managed to avoid the gas chamber or lengthy sentences in the first trial was due to racism. And I go into that in some detail. And Dorothy Kilgallen later on, she managed to, she was pretty crafty. She was waiting outside after the mistrial was called and the jurors were walking out, and she recognized these guys, the African-American man and the Latino man. She called them over, and earlier she had made friends with a newspaper vendor who tipped her off to a taxi phone. I don't know if those things still exist, but if you wanted to get a hold of a cab and you couldn't, a lot of people, hoteliers, had people, you know, who were greeting the arrivals at their hotel. There were actually phones outside where they lifted it up. It was a direct line to a taxi. And the newspaper vendor who she had made friends with and had actually said hello to on a What's My Line broadcast had tipped her off to this taxi phone. So once she got these guys in, she convinced them to have drinks with her. And she went over to the taxi phone, which was hidden behind a bush. She calls a taxi. The guys jump in, and she gets a scoop and manages to get these guys over to her hotel room at the Ambassador. And they start talking about the case. And lo and behold, one of them has kept a journal. And so she scooped, she got a lot of information. There was reportedly a leak. She knew how this was going to end before it ended. And so she had a mole in the jury. And I'm not sure who it was. I imagine it was one of these men. But she had quite a history that hasn't been written about in the case that I was able to piece some of it together by her columns, which she published on it. And that was just the first trial.
So they have to go through this. Yeah, they have to go through this three times. You're dealing with this constant shenanigans. I mean, is the case solidifying with each telling, or are they at risk of it breaking apart?
You know, they, whatever reasons, the jurors were, you know, I think because Finch was white and privileged and wealthy, I think they tended to believe what he said, that it was an accident, you know. And I think that's what saved him initially through the first three, first two trials. And they had even visited there. I retell the times that the juries visited the Finch home in West Covina, and court was in session. They could not talk. The judge led them around, gave them a tour of the grounds, and Finch was able to actually visit his invalid mother at the house, kind of sneak a visit on the occasions. But, you know, they had the facts, and still they wanted to believe that it was an accident. So, but it was still, the second trial was also, came out as a mistrial. And now they were going to have to go through this a third time. And eventually what ended up saving him is that the jury, the third jury, they actually went back to the house a second time. And they spent quite a bit of time in the garage and everything. And when they came back, they actually reenacted for themselves how Finch claimed that his wife died accidentally from the gunshot. And they realized that there was no physically human way that she could have been killed with the gun the way he said that she did. And that's how he ended up, he and Carol ended up getting convicted during the third trial. And there was a good chance they could have gone to the gas chamber. Carol Chessman, if you're familiar with him, had just been executed in the gas chamber for a lesser crime, for rape. And this was after many years of being held on death row. And this just happened shortly to their third conviction. The night of the, or the previous night, when they had been finally convicted and they were waiting for their sentence hearing, what's this guy's name? Spade Cooley, a famous Western swing singer, had murdered his wife. And so there was a lot of this, you know, it looked like a lot could have sort of colored the jurors' minds and the public if with Finch and Carol getting the death penalty. And they were lucky because eventually they just received life term sentences. Even though Carol did not murder Barbara Finch with a gun, did not hold the gun, the fact that she carried the murder case up there, the she was convicted more on conspiracy than the actual murder. So she was also penalized like Finch. So they were ultimately convicted at the third trial. But it took about 18 months from the beginning of the first trial to the end of the third one before they were finally convicted.
Is that natural? I mean, it just seems two mistrials to a third seems, like a lot to have had to deal with at that time. Do we get many cases that trip that up?
No, not that I've heard of. And there was even the possibility it could have gone to a fourth trial. The defense and the prosecutors were aware, they were prepared to go through a fourth trial, which would have made news in California because there'd never been, no court case, murder case had ever reached a fourth trial, but there was a chance this could have gone to a fourth trial. But finally, I think also what had happened, by the time of the third trial, a lot of the media circus, the interest had started to die down. The jurors were paying attention, and also people were racing to a finish line. You know, the prosecutors, the defense attorneys, Carol had her own separate defense attorneys from Finch's. So everybody was tired at this point, and, you know, the facts and the jury, I also, without the media hoopla around, they were actually paying attention, this third jury. And I think by their reenacting, they were able to basically look at the facts and not listen to any of this other stuff that was going around. And that's how they convicted Finch finally in the end. And he was surprised. I mean, this is the first, he was flabbergasted. He was dumbstruck that he was finally convicted, because all his life, from the time when he was let off on drunk driving charges to having these affairs with women with no repercussions, he had just sailed through life and got whatever he wanted and, you know, left a string of destruction and broken hearts and whatnot. And a dead wife, and he was sure he was going to beat the rap this time, and he was surprised. And even still, after this, he still wanted to get back with Carol after, but over a period of time, her heart changed about this matter.
Now, they didn't face a death penalty. They were both, as I understood, they were both released from prison after not being in for very long, right?
Well, they actually spent a number of years. So they were convicted in 1961. I think she got out, without my looking at my notes, I think she got out in 1969. I think she spent about 8 years. And then I think he was released in the early 70s. He spent a few more years than her. And, you know, interestingly, once she got out, she did a name change. And she stayed in her old stomping grounds. She ended up working at Inner Community Hospital in Covina, working in the records department. Even with the name change, all the employees knew who she was. But, you know, they would never discuss the case in front of her. They'd wait till she was gone on vacations. And she worked there for decades. And she was promoted, and then she finally retired. She is still alive. She's in her early 80s. I believe she still lives in the Covina area. And Finch ended up, once he got out of prison, he ended up, got a job offer as a medical x-ray technician, I believe, in Missouri. And he went there and he tried to get his medical license back. And it took, you know, they kept being promised. He took the test. He didn't happen. He finally came back to California in the early 80s, I believe, and he finally got his medical license back. I think it was in 1984, 85, and he ended up moving to Rancho Mirage near Palm Springs and practiced medicine again for about the last 10 or 11 years of his life, and finally passed away in 1995. And he is buried at the local cemetery in Glendora, where my family, where my parents are, where Barbara's buried, and Finch's family. And an interesting note that I talked about at the end of the book is that I had heard that Barbara Finch had been buried in Oakdale, I believe is the name of the cemetery, in Glendora. And so I came across on the internet that a woman with the same name had been buried at Forest Lawn in Covina, and went out there and tried to do some search, and they gave me the birth and death dates for this woman, and as it turns out, they didn't match Barbara Finch's. So I got to thinking, I'm going to call Oakdale again. So I did. They called me back about 10 minutes later, and yes, they said she was buried there. So they gave me the location of her burial site, and I went out there. I could not find it. I had a cemetery assistant come out. She looked and couldn't find him. Finally, she called the office and she says, well, who's buried on either side of Barbara Finch? And they gave her the names. And lo and behold, we found the grave. And guess what? It's an unmarked grave site. I think her family purposely did that. They did not want her people like me looking for it. They wanted to give her the one thing in that she didn't get in life, which was peace. And so that's where she is buried, not too far away from her the husband that murdered her.
Wow. Wow. Satin Pumps, the moonlit murder that mesmerized the nation. Even with all the amazing story that we just heard, there is so much more to absorb in this book. So many more details that you need to read and see for yourself. And remember, we have a link up for that book in today's program guide. Rate and review the book. Make sure that you put it out there so people know about it and it gets more exposure. Steve, thank you so much for coming on today and sharing this remarkable story.
Oh, you're welcome. My pleasure.
It has been a pleasure speaking with you. And again, my friends, I apologize for no Dumb Crime, Stupid Criminals this week, but we will be back in a week or two with more Dumb Crime, Stupid Criminals. But every week you will get, as promised, a brand new episode of True Crime Tuesday.